10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am sure many of you are acquainted with an absolutely riveting memoir out of the Gulf War called Jarhead, which was transformed into an equally riveting film starring Jake Gyllenhaal. The author of Jarhead and that memoir was Anthony Swofford, who has written a novel since then and now a new memoir. A memoir at both different and strikingly similar to that first memoir, a memoir called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. In this new memoir, Anthony Swofford is not telling the story of that battlefield of Jarhead, but rather, in a sense, a different sort of battlefield, an emotional and mental battlefield, as he waged, in a sense, a real struggle to try to come to grips with his own father and their very, very difficult, painful relationship. Anthony Swofford's father himself was a veteran of the Vietnam War, bearing all kinds of scars from that conflict and experience, which in turn informed the kind of husband and father that he was. And it was the need for him to come to grips with that, and for Anthony to come to grips with that, and for them to rebuild a relationship that was so incredibly dysfunctional and painful. And along the way, there are other struggles for Anthony Swofford as well. And he writes about all of them with disarming honesty and frankness and insight as well. This new memoir, again, is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. The book is a publication of 12 books, and I am very, very honored to be able to speak with the author, Anthony Swofford. Anthony Swofford, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Could you tell me a little bit about how this memoir felt different to write from your first memoir, Jarhead? Because I'm struck by how, in some ways, it sounds like very much the same voice, and yet you are talking about very different things. How different did it feel to write this memoir versus the earlier one?
But it felt quite different. Jarhead being my first book, I spat that one out. I wrote that book in about 8.5 months, 9 months. And I don't think I could write a book that quickly now. That was my first book, and there was some energy and some drive. And I knew that story. And what's different about this new book is that I started it having no idea how it would end. I knew the start point was jumping in this RV with my father on our first trip, and I started writing the book shortly after that trip ended, and I started mining our past. And at that point, I didn't know that there would be two more RV trips, and I didn't really know what my life was going to look like 2.5 years later when I was finishing the book. So in some ways, it was very much a real-time writing of the book. That's not totally true. It's not as though I was in the RV composing, but as I was living the life, I was doing the hard work of pulling it in, and having it at the ready when I needed to really narrate it and get it down on the page. And so the practice of writing for this book was a very different practice than with Jarhead.
I want to ask you briefly about the Iowa Writers Workshop. Am I remembering the name of that correctly? I don't want to get it wrong like your father always got it wrong. He called it the Writer's Warehouse, I think.
He did call it the Writer's Warehouse, yeah.
I happen to grow up in Iowa, so I don't want you to misunderstand this question. I love Iowa, and I resent people who misunderstand Iowa's and characterize it in certain ways as just a land of cornfields and so on. That being said, I have to confess that I was sort of amazed at the thought that someone would go to the Iowa Writers Workshop and the books that would result from that would be a book like Jarhead or a book like this one. I mean, hard-hitting, raw, difficult, painful memoirs. When I just imagine the Iowa Writers Workshop in my head, and I'd heard about it before, I just somehow on some stupid level imagine just idyllic books about cornfields, I suppose, ensuing out of that. I mean, it's just, it never even dawned on me that at the Iowa Writers Workshop, it would be the real stuff of all kinds of different life stories, including your own.
Yeah, the graduates of the workshop definitely pump out the occasional cornfield book. They're out there. But the great thing about the workshop, well, there's it's been around since 1935. And so American letters of the last century are very much marked by the people who studied there and people who taught there. And it's a multi-variegated place with many voices and many stories coming out of it. I happened to be there in the late 90s, and I was certainly the only of my type at that point. I was this guy who'd been in the Marines, and most of my peers there were, East Coast private school, Ivy College types. And so I was a bit of a fish out of water there, but not really because, I wanted to be a writer. And that's, once you're there, that's really all that matters is your dedication to the craft. When I was there, the great writer Frank Conroy was running the place, and he really loved writers. He cared about teaching, and he wanted to give budding writers a place where they could try anything out and work hard. And his thing was, just you've got to sit in your chair every day for 4 hours and get the work done.
Did you feel self-conscious as the only person of your particular background to be there, or did they do something to make you feel welcome and feel open about sharing what it was that was inside of you?
I was very self-conscious and incredibly so, and didn't really write about the Marine Corps at first, or having been in the Marines. It was the dot-com boom time, and everyone was talking about their buddy who just got a job in Silicon Valley making $300,000 a year, et cetera, et cetera. And that bled into the workshop, too, that kind of that idea of the riches of the dot-com boom. And so when I started writing about the military, there was definitely some sort of open and not hidden disdain for what I was writing about. And people, some of my peers said, what are you writing about this war? No, we're not at war. No one even remembers this war. It was not important. That was some of the reaction. But I think the more nuanced thinkers and the people who were bigger thinkers, and certainly my teachers, saw that I was on top of this gold mine of a subject, which was the military and warfare and the internal landscapes of the people who do that fighting, and that was rare there at the time. After World War II, there were a slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa, and after Vietnam, there was a whole slew of veteran writers who came through Iowa. But I was one of the first from the Gulf War.
This book is mostly about you and your father, although it's certainly about other important relationships in your life, including the relationship with your brother Jeff, who unfortunately died of cancer, your relationship with certain women, with your mother. But it's mostly about your efforts to try to rebuild the fractured relationship with your father. At one point in the book, you write, "No one else will write about my father, so I am his writer. And in the act of writing, I hope to become again his loving son." There's a lot wrapped up in those few words, but one of them is in that first sentence. I mean, what a mantle of responsibility to be the only person who will ever sit down and write something significant about your father. Was that at all a hindrance or, in a sense, an intimidating burden to bear, particularly as you wrote about your father in this memoir?
It was a, I don't know that it was a hindrance, but it was certainly, it certainly got in the way sometimes, and it was in my face. But, you know, I won't kid anyone. There's some dark stuff in this book, and my father was kind of a dark, haunted guy, and he was, especially when I was a kid, he was a man I feared, and then when I was an adult, because of some of his behaviors, he was a man I had trouble respecting, but I needed to understand him, and I understand the world and people best when I'm writing and when I'm writing about them. And he was this massive figure. He was in every room I walked into, and he marked me. You know, people are marked by their fathers, and I'm no different. And I was pushing 40, and we'd begun taking these RV trips together, and my father's ill. And you know, some people would say, wait till he passes away and then write about him. But I felt that wouldn't do anyone any service. And I felt an urgency to write about him, and by writing about him, you know, to understand him, and to hopefully, you know, make it a healing act as well. And I remember writing those words that you quoted. I remember exactly where I was when I wrote them. I was in this little writing shed that I have in upstate New York near our house. And when I wrote those words, I think I finally, whatever was in the way, whatever had been in the way in terms of me being able to write about my father, by writing those words, I got rid of them. And I got rid of those hindrances, those blockages, and I took on the burden of writing about my father with a new kind of verve and a new kind of clarity.
Ironically, those words appear in the chapter where you are telling us about a bombshell letter. I mean, I mean that in a couple different ways, because you characterize this letter yourself as, it was though a bomb went off in your face and left, you know, shredded flesh. It was that painful. Your father had written this over the course of, I think, maybe several years, pouring out a lot of his anger and resentment and frustration and disappointment. And so it's so interesting to think about, on the one hand, when he took pen and paper and wrote something, it was venting all this anger. And in the midst of sharing that experience with us of what it felt like to receive this kind of letter from your own father, you're writing about writing in a way that will, you hope, bring the two of you back together again.
Yeah, his letter was explosive. It did. It landed in my mailbox, and I knew what it was. It was heavy enough that I knew exactly what it was. And there's a way in which I've been anticipating this letter for a few years. My brother had received a similar letter at one point with my father, letting him know how displeased he was with him as a son. And I didn't open this letter for a few weeks. I threw it in the top drawer of my desk because I wasn't prepared for it. And then, you know, one night I said, well, okay, here we go. Let's do it. Let's see what the old man says. And, you know, he took me to task, and he had some understandable grievances and some things that were just completely outlandish and ridiculous. And so he, you know, in a way, he wrote me. He chose to write me by writing that letter to me. He wrote a narrative of me. He rendered me in a way that I thought was not really fair. And And so then I needed to go in and write him and really, you know, rewrite myself, tell my side of the stories that he tells in that letter. And, yeah, my father's a pretty good writer, and he's pretty strong rhetorically. And there's a bit of, you know, prose sword rattling that goes on there from the both of us, which I think it will be fascinating for a reader to see and to experience.
I quite agree, and it's certainly a testament to the power of words, and the power of words when they are wielded well, as he does, and as you wield them actually even better in your memoir. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anthony Swafford. You may know that name. I suspect you know that name from his very powerful previous memoir, Jarhead, which stems from his experiences in the Gulf War. His newest memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. Your father, as I mentioned earlier, was a Vietnam veteran and came away from that conflict, unfortunately, as so many Vietnam vets did, bearing all kinds of different scars. And that played out certainly in the way kind of husband and father that he was. One thing I find interesting about the way you describe your life growing up with him is that you are careful, I think, in every case to say your father was occasionally abusive, both verbally and physically. But I think every time you mention that, you always use the word occasionally. I wonder how conscious a choice that was. And is it for the reason of pulling back from simply saying he was abusive and maybe painting a picture that you don't want to paint or a picture that would not be fully fair? Can you just talk about that word occasionally?
Yeah, that's a very careful reading on your part, and it's something that I probably hadn't noticed. I don't think that was deliberate. I think, you know, admitting that was difficult. It was difficult for me to write about. It was difficult to out my father as that kind of a father. And also, I guess, you know, once you open that up, then you know, the fear is the die cast. Will I be that same kind of father one day? Which is, you know, another important aspect of the story is me trying to figure out if I have what it takes to be a father. Because I love my father, but I do not ever want to be the kind of father that he was. In his good moments, in his moments of love and his moments of good fathering, sure, I can learn some things. But there were many other moments where, you know, he was an abusive guy. I guess I do pull back a little bit, and I probably pull back in order, you know, to protect myself more than anything else.
This is as good a moment as any for me to ask you one thing that I really struggled to understand. At one point, you, I believe, are quoting someone else's book, and now I don't have that exact moment in the book in front of me, but you quote a line, and you even, here it is, from Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I rewrote thousands of times this quote, a good father is not a good father.
Right. I love that quote, and it's something that I try to think about that every day, in fact. I'm thinking about having it tattooed on my body somewhere. I think that Suzuki quote, the essence of that is that, you know, if you decide that you're a good father, you're going to slip and you're not going to be a good father, and that each day you must become a good father again. That's what it means to me. And that each day I will learn what it means to be a good father. When, you know, today my daughter is 9 months old, and to be a good father this morning, you know, was one thing, and to be a good father tomorrow morning will probably be a different thing. And that's the challenge for me as a father.
Your encounters with your father that we read about in this book, I mean, some of it stems from your very difficult childhood, and we'll leave it to our listeners to read about some of the things your father did. in some of the ways he was abusive, and in some of the ways he was simply inattentive, or inattentive in ways that were really painful to you. By the time the events of this book, the present day events, so to speak, roll around, your father has been diagnosed with something called COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. And so this is also the story of your father's precipitous physical decline. And I wonder how significant you think that was in the ultimate reconnection, which does occur to some extent with you and your father, that how much of that had to do with this crushing reality of your father literally losing the ability to breathe. And do you ever wonder about how this time and this reapproachment might have played out differently if your father had remained in robust health?
Yeah, I do. It's definitely, it's the ticking clock of the book. You know, every book needs a ticking clock, and the one here is, you know, will this sick man die? The real life ticking clock for me was like, well, will my father die before we're able to work through this? And the ticking clock in the narrative is the same thing. Is this old guy going to die before his son and he come to some kind of understanding? And it's totally possible that if my father was robust and healthy and had no issues, we never would have gone on these trips, and we would have possibly remained at odds. I have a number of male friends who have fathers who are elderly, and they've never had these conversations. They might have similar problems with their fathers, but their fathers never made the effort to have these deep and difficult conversations. And you know, I have to give my father a lot of credit, because he invited me on that first RV trip, and he's the one who reached out across the cabin in the middle of the night on the first night of driving and said, hey, son, let's have a talk. Let's clear the air.
What's so interesting, I think, is that he reaches across the cab, you tell us, and grabs my forearm and says, Tone, I think we need to get some things out in the open and clear the air. I think you need to get some venom out. And he says that repeatedly. It's such an interesting choice of words. But what you go on to describe is a situation in which your father doesn't seem to really understand what that means. I mean, he doesn't really seem to have much understanding at all of just how deep the venom goes and how much of it is tied up in your father and how he mistreated you. And in a sense, it is this messy, awful can of worms, and he has no idea of what he is potentially opening up. That's one of the most fascinating things to see here.
Yeah, I don't think he knows what he's asking for. You know, when he asks me to get the venom out, which is, you know, my father's choice of words, and it was pretty accurate. And he used it again and again over these different trips, and it's as though, you know, he was asking for something and didn't really know the totality of it, and I understand that. I understand that. Probably when we behave badly, we don't always want to come face to face with the reality of those consequences. And that was my father there. You know, in a way, I think my father would have preferred that on that first trip, when he asked me that I say, "Hey, Dad, you know, I'm beyond it now. It's okay. A, B, C, D, E, F, and G happened, and I'm okay with those things now." But I really wasn't.
Right. You write at one point, my father did not want to hear what I had to say. He considered the case closed on most of my grievances. The statute of limitations expired. You also write, much later in the book, this might even be on I'm pretty sure it must be on another of these RV trips you take together, that your father can't imagine that the rift in our relationship has anything to do with our relationship. He's looking for someone or something to blame. And in this case, as you're struggling through this, money and I are to blame. But in a sense, your father is not really ready to to face up to the emotional center of your relationship. And again, it's so interesting to imagine the two of you trying to effect this connection. It really helps us appreciate just how difficult, in fact, that can be.
It was very difficult. It was, you know, sometimes it was maddening for me because you know, as you pointed out, my father would ask for something that I don't think he was prepared to completely deal with, and the emotional reality of, you know, what happens when you ask your son to get the venom out, you know, is probably something different than what you were anticipating, and for him it certainly was. And you know, my grievances with him, they ran deep, but they also, you know, you're just, you know, like Faulkner said, you know, the past isn't past, it isn't even over yet. And so when I had my grievances with my father, they would, you know, pass through him into his grievances with him, his father, and into his trauma over his mother dying when he was a month old, and there's reverb, and that stuff comes back to me. It's so complex and fascinating, you know, fathers and sons, and for me as a writer, you know, I was sitting on this relationship, which was the you know, the most troubling relationship I'd ever had. I had to write about it. I, you know, I had to live it, and I also this had to be, you know, my next book, trying to figure this man out, and then, you know, simultaneously trying to figure myself out.
Right. One of the things you were angriest about with your father is that he did not come to the funeral of your brother Jeff, who tragically passed away from cancer. Your brother Jeff, who was a stupendous athlete and very good to you on many, many levels, and to see him waste away and finally be claimed by cancer was, of course, tremendously painful for you, for your whole family, and for your father, who kept his distance, who stayed away from that funeral, and that's one of the real linchpins to your rupture. I want to ask you about something you write about your brother Jeff. I should think this was not easy, that in the wake of his death, one of the things that lingered were all of his lies. For all that you admired about your brother, he told all kinds of lies about himself, all kinds of tall tales about, well, this and that, wonderful things he had done or accomplished that, in fact, were not true. I wonder if it was painful and difficult for you to share this part of the story of your brother, Jeff.
Extremely so. When I was a kid, you know, my brother was my hero, and he was a great brother. He was a lovely, lovely guy, and you know, to write, he was kind of a compulsive liar. He told lies about things he'd done and places he'd been, and when I realized that, and then when I was sitting down working on it and writing about it, it saddened me deeply, because he was a great guy and he didn't need to tell lies about, you know, playing an exhibition game with the San Francisco 49ers, or you know, the list goes on. And I felt, you know, what was sad was thinking that he must have felt like whatever he was doing wasn't good enough, and so he needed to create these alternative stories of who he was, and that saddened me, because I think who he was perfectly fine, and that he should have been happy with who he was, and he should have lived, you know, in his life rather than fabricating these other lives, and that realization was extremely sad.
Absolutely. You write, the man dies, his deeds remain, and so too his lies. Back to the very beginning of the book, you write, I believed there existed no grander test for a man than combat. Every other pursuit was pure, unimportant leisure when compared to a firefight. I suspect that you maybe do not believe that, at least to the same extent. Do you see other tests of a man that are nearly as powerful as those in combat?
I do. I mean, I see fatherhood as now the ultimate test. I think that was a young man's view and a young man's romance with combat and what it would mean and what it could mean. But you know, now I'm a father, and that will be my test is whether or not I'm a good father and what kind of fathering I do to my daughter, what kind of husband I am. Those are the tests and the ones that that I want to pass day to day.
Anthony Swofford, his memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails, a memoir published by 12 Books. It is 20 minutes, now 19 minutes actually, before 9 o'clock, and part two of today's morning show will be coming up in just a moment here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. For part two of today's program, you're going to hear a portion of the conversation I recorded with musician Mike Doty, best known for his work in the group Soul Coughing. But his memoir, called A Book of Drugs, is mostly a story of dysfunction and of a ruinous drug addiction that nearly claimed Mike Doty's life. His book, The Book of Drugs, is published by Da Capo Press. You actually grew up in a military family with a dad who ultimately became head of the history department at West Point. So that's, of course, an interesting reality to react against. But the other thing is that you had a mother that seems to have been mentally or emotionally a bit unstable. You talk a lot about how, as a youngster, you had all kinds of dreams and wishes, particularly revolving around music, but that you followed those dreams with a real sense of kind of desperation and even dread. It is so strange to hear somebody talking about their own dreams in those kind of terms. What do you think was at the heart of that? And in a sense, was that a precursor of where all of this was ultimately going to take you? I mean, is that a part of what ultimately happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, on two levels. I mean, for one thing, it began when music had like a medicinal value. You know, when it would change my feelings, I would feel some warmth and some safety. You know, there was all this bipolar stuff going on in my house and suppressed alcoholism and, you know, a crazy household. And it was something that worked for me. Suddenly I realized when I was like 13, like, this is what I'm supposed to do with my life. But there's no way it's ever going to happen. Like, I just had no faith that it was going to happen. But I was just like, I have to pursue this. I know I'm going to fail. But like, I have to cling to this impossible dream.
You say at one point, in trying to describe what you were like as a really smart and gifted young person growing up, that self-loathing freed you to be weird.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the other thing, is there was so much self-hatred. I mean, really, like the initial benefit of the drugs was it shut off that voice in my head so I could actually write a song. I didn't feel, there was a certain amount of social pressure I didn't feel, particularly in the context of West Point, which is not a bohemian enclave. because I just thought, like, I'm just not up to par with these people, you know? Like, I'm a lowlife, and, like, you know, thus there's less pressure on me.
And one thing I thought was interesting is you kind of described this persona that became yours is that a lot of the people around you found you, in your words, fascinating and frightening. And I think for those of us who, for whatever reason, didn't grow up going anywhere near any of this, I mean, so, you know, I was the guy who would have been on the opposite end of the cafeteria probably from you. But it's really interesting to read about how this kind of life and being this kind of person can be, for certain other people, very alluring, very, very fascinating. I mean, even if you don't want to be that, I mean, probably other kids looked at you and did not want to be you. And then probably some of them thought, wow, I want what he wants. I want to have what he has.
Right. I mean, I don't think a lot of them went for it, really. But, you know, really, it's true of a lot of addicts is we can fear recovery because we think we're going to have to give up our eccentricities and our weirdnesses. And, in fact, that's a lot of what, for me, the appeal of drugs was as a signifier of my outsider-ness. Mm-hmm. So... It was a means of being different, and I just cultivated that difference. And the beauty of getting clean was I found people who were also weird, and they had a lot of years sober. And I was like, if you can be weird, and you can be artists, and you know, have your own freaky system of references, I want what you have.
We're speaking with Mike Doty, talking about his memoir, The Book of Drugs. When we follow you as you are first trying to put together your artistic life, we hear some really interesting experiences, including some of your very first gigs. I think the very first one playing in a bar where there were literally two guys there, and before long it's just you and the bartender. I mean, things begin in quite unpromising fashion. Then you start meeting some really interesting people who make a difference for you. I wonder if you would just say a quick word about something called Cobra that was a really interesting experience for you. I'd never heard about this exactly, and it sounds like it was a really exciting experience for you and other musicians.
Yeah, Cobra is a John Zorn piece, and he wrote these series of pieces that he called Game Pieces. And essentially, it's a way of structuring improvisation. So you would each individual player, you have about 12 of them in a semicircle, facing a guy at a table with all these cards. And you would make a signal, like by you touch your nose, you touch your ear, and then point upwards. And it was like volume, speed, change your part completely, return to a part. And it was such a joy, and you really got... you know, you get a bunch of people in the room together and they would play together, and there was just this, like, kind of, you know, jumping around in the mud quality. And it's an amazing piece. And, like, I encourage, like, if you're a weird musician and you know 10 other weird musicians, like, find this piece and, you know, put it on somewhere because it is so much fun.
Mm. Eventually, you meet up with a very gifted musician by the name of Jeff Buckley. He seems to have played a really important role in who you became. And, of course, you talk a little bit about his sad demise when he drowned himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, I met him actually doing Cobra, which is, you know, like it was just, they would throw the weirdest people together. And we played around New York. I was so insanely jealous of the guy. He was beautiful. I mean, you walk into a party with Jeff Buckley, and the girls are not looking at you. So there was so much envy. It was really like, you know, when he died, my reaction was, oh, great, he's a legend now. Great. He's immortal now. God damn it. You know, which is such a, you know, like the dead guy doesn't win. I mean, besides the fact that is just an awful, awful way to look at another human being and how horrified and depressed I was when I realized, like I was this guy's friend. How could I have thought that way? Hmm. You know, there's just that glamour of, you know, I want to be famous. I don't care if I live.
Right. It was interesting, by the way, that the two of you had watched a tape of the German play Wozzeck, which is also transformed by a German composer, Alban Berg, into a really
Indeed.
Remarkable opera. And
yeah.
Anybody who wants to experience something really disturbing and heartbreaking should experience
yeah.
Wozzeck. You ultimately, of course, join up with some other musicians to form this band called Soul Coughing. We should say that for all the success that you guys enjoyed, in many respects, enjoy is the wrong word, at least for you.
Oh, yeah.
As you describe this experience, it just seems to be so fraught with unhappiness and resentment and ultimately very destructive bitterness. Can you just say a word about what it was about these particular guys that
right.
made musical success possible, and yet on a personal level and even a professional level to some extent, made it, in a sense, such a disaster?
Well, bands are marriages. And, you know, some of them are dark marriages. And Soul Coughing was the darkest, most emotionally abusive, verbally violent, toxic relationship. I was 22 when we put our first gig together, and those guys were in their 30s. And they were all tremendous musicians. And they obviously sort of looked on me with disdain. And, you know, they were playing in 30 different bands each. And, like, my value to them was, like, on a Tuesday night, they could make $20 on, you know, whatever gig I had the 10 people showed up to. But they suddenly we got a record deal. I really wanted to share things with them. I was wanted them to have equity in these songs. But, of course, the bulk of the songs I had written in their entirety, a lot of them years before I met those guys. And so, you know, I wanted more money. I mean, you know, they were my songs. And they refused to have anything but the most equal cut. And they were so very spiteful of me, because I was the singer and the songwriter, and I was precocious, and I was a kid. And there was just so much emotional abuse in the band. I mean, it really was an engine of spite, you know. It seemed like after a while, I mean, the first record was like they would play my stuff because they'd learned the stuff when they, when they were like, whatever, who cares about this kid? But then from then on, I got to realize, like, my God, if I say I want to do something, they will automatically, like, do everything they can to push against it and denigrate me. I mean, and, you know, a lot of it appears delusional to me in the sense that some of them really thought that, you know, well, you know, Dodie's doing this thing, but really what I'm doing is what's important here. And, you know, I can't believe we're saddled with this guy.
And ultimately, it seems as though you had so much rage and bitterness within you that you didn't even know what to do. And of course, all of this time, you're using all kinds of substances.
Oh, yeah.
And I suspect that rage and bitterness just made all of that worse. Did it also cause some of this in the first place? Just what sort of an effect was it? Cause, effect, both?
Well, I mean, I think the bottom cause of it was I grew up in an emotionally violent house. And if you are that guy, and I'm an addict, and I'm bipolar, and I got all this stuff happening, I went out and I just found, a replacement family. I found, like, you know, the ersatz family. And, you know, if those guys had vanished in the rapture, I would have found three more equally emotionally abusive guys. Hmm. As for the drugs, like, I feel that at my core, I'm an addict. And that's got something to do with something, genetic or, you know, some propensity that is passed on, but it is triggered by, I think, trauma. So if you're in pain from a kid, from your from the time you're a kid, it's just going to happen. You know, you're going to find your way to those drugs.
Right. I'm reminded of something you say, actually, about back in your childhood and some of the huge fights which went on between your parents, some of which ended up being focused on you. And you said it was because the awfulness needed a place to go. And in some ways, I wonder about this life which you and your bandmates had, that because there was so much abuse going on, in some respects, there was so much awfulness there that had to go someplace, that had to be heaped on someone's head. And you, as the head of this band, the target of resentment, you are where so much of this awfulness went. Not that you didn't create some of that awfulness yourself with your own. So ultimately, of course, your book is also about recovery. You speak so honestly about that in terms of the real reality, the real possibility that you resist the temptation to speak with perfect assurance and confidence that your recovery is permanent. Can you just say a word about that, about speaking about your recovery in those kind of terms? I mean, is that an honest reflection of how you feel, or are you more kind of running away from what has been kind of the blithe false assurances of other people who have told similar stories in the past?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is whatever that thing is, and like I said, the word disease, it just doesn't feel right to me. But I will always have this. And I see people who have years clean, and suddenly they're like, you know what, I can drink a glass of wine. And then 2 weeks later, they're crackheads. Like, literally. I mean, that sounds like an exaggeration, but people pick up where they left off. You know, you got a decade in between you and the last time you used. If you use again, you are right back there almost immediately. So I never take this for granted.
Tell us, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but could you say a word about how work, making music, has figured into your recovery, aside from what has been really important to you, of course, the whole 12-step thing? But what about music and what about work? What role has that played in achieving recovery and maintaining it?
Well, a really important thing for me was, I'm a John Coltrane fan for years, but I read the liner notes to A Love Supreme, which is considered his magnum opus. He speaks in straight up 12-step jargon. And he says, by the grace of God, humbly asked, like phrases that are from the 12 steps. And it just blew my mind, because what this guy did was he got clean in 57, and then his music just kept getting weirder. And it just expanded, and he just had this fire and this, like, insane drive. And, you know, when I was a kid, I would look at the guys on the cover of People magazine and think, you make terrible records. Why would I want to stop doing drugs? And Coltrane was the guy who gave me the epiphany of, like, oh, my God, I can, like, really chase art and try and work at my highest level. You know, I don't have to, like, join the PTA and wear sweater vests.
Mike Doty, an excerpt from the interview which we recorded upon the publication of his powerful memoir about his harrowing descent into serious drug abuse and the recovery which he was eventually able to make. His book is A Book of Drugs and published by Da Capo Press. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we welcome into our studios Chancellor Debbie Ford from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside on the eve of yet another school year at UW-Parkside. We are excited about her visit to the program. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.